Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Coming up on the show, will Wes Streeting be the next Prime Minister? And Keir Starmer gets defensive as his position looks less and less stable. After this, we'll be discussing the 23,000 Epstein emails released by Congress that shed new light on Trump's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media.
But first, it's the week unwrapped. Ali, you have actually done some interesting things over the past couple of weeks. And listeners may remember that you weren't with me in the studio, although we did have some very good guests standing in your place. But you were in New York seeing in the victory of the new mayor, Zoran Mamdani. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, breaking news, I got through TSA with no problems at all, which was
is
nice.
It, right, I'm not, it is a shame because it would have been...
What do you mean it's a shame that I got through TSA?
It would have been good if you hadn't, not obviously not for you.
Yeah, I had the press releases already. I'm going on hunger strike, please let me go.
It would have been great for the show.
Yeah.
It would have been a good story.
And you've just exposed that you would have loved it if I'd been in a nice detention centre.
And I would have laughed.
Yeah.
But aside from that...
no, I got through fine. It was brilliant. Look, I went... I got invited to go meet some of the Mamdani campaign staff, to meet Mamdani himself, to kind of go onto the campaign trail, see how they're doing things differently, how they're doing some things the same. And it was cool. It was like an injection, a little bit of injection of hope, really, because... what you had basically the antithesis of a UK-based candidate, someone who was charismatic, exciting, was speaking to the issues. He was an absolute celebrity. We went to a... what's funny was I was supposed to meet him on Saturday. So there was a rally for Muslims and South Asians. And that was following some of the Islamophobic attacks that he had come under. And they said to me, I flew in on Friday and they said, yo, just come on Saturday. You can meet him there. You can chat to him and then you can get to know some of the campaign staff. And there was a rally of about 500 people. So it wasn't a huge rally. But he was so mobbed by people after the rally that we didn't get a chance to properly speak. So I had to see him the next day. But it's honestly, I've not seen since Jeremy Corbyn in 2015. I would say this was even more than that. Mm. There was an excitement in the city, a buzz about him, and he had pulled people into the political conversation and into voting who don't traditionally vote. So it was really, really exciting, and it was cool to see some of the things that they were doing differently. And then, of course, he goes ahead and wins with 50.4%. It's the highest turnout, I think, in a mayoral election or municipality election in New York in 50 years. I think that speaks to how many people who don't traditionally vote in a sort of mayoral race that he inspired to come out and vote. Of course, now he has to deliver.
So what's Mamdani's secret sauce then? Like, why is he so popular? Why did he galvanise the crowds? We've been talking a lot about his social media campaign over the past few shows, but is that a bit reductive? Is there more to him than just, you know, shiny Instagram videos?
Well, so that's kind of why what I went there to see, because I wanted to know if it's possible in London, if it's possible in other European cities, whether we can have that kind of campaign, that kind of excitement. Because if you'd asked me if someone with Mamdani's story was possible in New York, I would have said it's more possible in somewhere like London. We probably have a more malleable sort of political climate and a population to that sort of thing. Because you think of New York, you think of Wall Street, right? You think of London, you kind of do think of the city, but London is more than that. So I wanted to get a sense of what was the secret sauce, as you say, because I thought it can't just be the videos. So I met with his campaign staff, I met with different organizational people who were there. And for folks who don't know, when he first launched, he was polling on 1%. No one knew who the brother was. And he went from there to defeating a sort of political icon in New York, or a stalwart, even as crooked as he is, in Andrew Cuomo. So I was kind of digging for what that secret source is. And you know what? It turns out it was the videos.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They said when they first launched, no one kind of knew what he was. He did these man on the street videos where no one would even stop to talk to him. And then once he got pumping some of this exciting, dynamic video content on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, that sort of stuff, the campaign got life out of those. So it was the videos. Yeah.
And obviously,
I would say he's the first influencer to win an election.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen him do some of his debating against his opponents, and he's very quick, he's sharp, he's got some good lines, but those Instagram videos are super slick.
And the candidate is good, by the way. So when I say he's an influencer, that doesn't mean he's not politically sharp, or don't think of him as a YouTuber. He's extremely political sharp. I got to speak to him for a little bit on a bridge at sunrise. He's politically astute, he's smart, he's sharp, he's been in the system, he's been an assemblyman, but yeah, the campaign was an influencer campaign. It was the videos, 100%.
And how do you think he's going to do actually as mayor? Is he going to, I mean, talk about the policies he ran on, and then do you think he's going to be able to implement them?
Yeah, so the message discipline was amazing, to the point where if you watch back his victory speech, he gets the crowd to chant back what the policies were, and that was a very common thing when we would go to campaign events, rallies, that sort of stuff. They would chant the first half of the sentence of the policy and the crowd would chant the second half back. That's how memorized it was. So it was fast and free buses in New York City. It was universal childcare. It was state-run grocery stores. And it was freezing the rent. It was those four things that he ran on. And so some of those things are easier to do as mayor of New York than others. So freezing the rent, the New York mayor controls the board that decides what the rents are in these, what they call rent-stabilized apartments.
Right.
So that he can do pretty easily. Things like the fast and free buses or the universal childcare require some money. And he's spoken about an increase in 2% tax on the wealthiest in New York. I think he's going to need some statewide Senate and governor support, which he's working on now. That's how politics works. But I think I've said to you since I've been back that one of the reasons I'm hopeful about him is he's very alive to the fact that the moment he won, we went for like drinks and meetings and stuff. And there was a moment of realization for me that I said to everyone, you guys need to realize that as we're sitting here having celebratory drinks, halal drinks for me, for the audience, there will be billionaires, CEOs and interest groups meeting somewhere else, probably in Wall Street, with a notepad and a pen, figuring out how do we make sure that this guy isn't successful. And he is very alive to the fact that there will be people working day and night, waking up every morning and going to sleep every night, thinking about how his term as mayor should be a failure, as so it doesn't inspire cities like New York, Barcelona, Paris, elsewhere.
Absolutely. Super interesting. Do you think you're going to be able to get Mamdani to come here and come on the politics?
Well, he's we might be able to get him in virtually. He's very keen on not leaving New York. So it was part of his thing. One of the
he's worried about getting apprehended at the border.
at this stage, I don't know if Trump would let him back in.
Yeah.
He's very keen on, because there was a big discussion around what's the first foreign city you'll visit, and everyone answered Israel on stage, which was so strange.
Also, not a city.
First foreign country.
Yes.
That you would visit as
just
as
checking
mayor
my
of,
geography yeah, there as well.
As mayor of New York. And so he's kind of keen to stay in the city. We'll try and get him digitally, though.
We should.
Yeah,
I will hold you to that.
I'll drop him a text, although I don't think I'll get any replies.
Let's see. Okay, well, we'll move on to the next big story of the week. This is about the row going on at the Beeb. So the BBC Director General Tim Davey and the CEO of News, Deborah Turnus, have resigned after a newspaper report suggested a BBC Panorama documentary misled viewers by editing a speech by US President Donald Trump. Right-wing media has, of course, pounced on this story. And we should say this report that was sequentially leaked to The Telegraph has indeed come under scrutiny itself for the political ideology of the author, Michael Prescott, and the fact that if it was such an important BBC report, why was it finding its way into The Telegraph day after day? But I'm sure we'll come on to that. But some have claimed that the BBC's mistake was unforgivable, and others have suggested that this could really be the beginning of the end for the BBC. We also know Donald Trump is threatening to sue the BBC, I believe, for libel on this particular Panorama edit. And I think it's by tomorrow, so that'll be Friday, we will know whether or not the BBC has responded. Ali, what do you make of all this?
So the best that I can make out of this scandal is that someone who was editing this video, presumably on Premiere Pro, just forgot to add a fade out to the video. Because it's the speech that he gives on January 6th, right? And the way it's spliced together, it looks like it's one coherent speech, whereas they've taken bits and edited it out of context. Whereas if you just had a fade out to white and then fade back in from white, you would know, the audience would know the different parts of the speeches.
If you're,
that's what this is all about, right?
If you're writing a newspaper report, you know, a story.
You do dot, dot, dot.
You
right?
do dot, dot, dot.
Yeah. So someone in, didn't in do brackets. Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And the beep might go out of business.
In the in broadcasting, you do fade to white.
Yeah.
Also, Donald Trump did incite an insurrection.
Yeah.
That is a verifiable fact. It is slightly
And it's gone to court in America, by the way. And it's been... It's been decided on in a US based court as well.
But what I think is more significant about this, my personal view is I suspect the Trump thing will fade out, because I don't think there is, and I could be proved wrong by tomorrow, but I think the legal grounds for which he is trying to get the BBC
sue the BBC
to give
for
money,
$1 trillion
billion. Trillion does sound extraordinary, but it is in fact $1 billion.
Oh, I heard trillion.
No.
Oh, that's less exciting. Is that enough to bankrupt the BBC though?
It would definitely not be a helpful amount of money to be taken from the office. But the broader point is this Prescott report, which formed the basis for this, and which cited this particular Panorama transgression, which came out with a number of claims about impartiality at the BBC, accusing it of bias, accusing it of being biased towards its coverage of Israel, accusing it of being biased towards its coverage of gendered issues.
Bias in which way? On which side?
Anti-Israel. Yes, I know. Isn't it extraordinary?
Wait,
because
so
those on the left would say it's actually the other way around.
So the claim is that the BBC has been anti-Israel.
Mm. In the Prescott report, that was the claim.
Do you remember one time I said, oh, if that's true, I'm an Olympic swimmer?
Mm.
If the BBC is anti-Israel, then I'm fucking Neil Armstrong and I've been to the moon.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that that this report certainly did seem to have its political alliances of its own. And there have been some questions about, for a long time, about the political leanings of the BBC board, the Director General, Robbie Gibb, and now Prescott. And it feels like, to me, this has been a huge incident that's unfurled over the weekend, but it's actually been a long time coming, because for a long time we've seen the infiltration of the BBC by right-wing figureheads who have pushed and pushed on the BBC to move rightwards and have been absolutely under attack by other news channels and broadsheet papers like The Telegraph, The Times, about its impartiality. Nigel Farage has obviously jumped on this. Meanwhile, Nigel Farage hosts his own news show on GB News. You know, it is an extraordinary amount of hypocrisy going on. And listen, I think the BBC has obviously made some mistakes. I would say that as somebody who comes from a left-leaning perspective. I think the Panorama thing was a mistake. I think an apology is reasonable. I have found other issues with their coverage before. But it is a massive news organisation. It is a pillar of our democracy. Yes, it should hold its hands up to mistakes. It should be accountable. It should reform where necessary. But it is vitally important we protect the BBC from people like Nigel Farage and Donald Trump, people who seek to discredit it. It is the media organisation that doesn't have any grubby donors behind it. It doesn't have any obvious political alliances. Does that make it infallible? No. But it does make it very, very important. That's my view.
No, I think you're right. There's been a quiet war on BBC for a really, really long time. And I guess the question to ask folks, particularly these people on the right about who claim to be patriotic about this country, there are certain things about Britain and British politics, British society, that are pillars, basically. The NHS is one, for example, in terms of politics and society. I think the BBC is a central part of British tradition, of British culture, of British society. I mean, and there has been, in my view, a coordinated war on the BBC for a while now from folks who want to destroy it. I think their vision is they want an American-style news ecosystem in this country where you go to the news channel that best reflects your existing political views. There's always been, I believe in my lifetime, this basic understanding that we do have news with editorial leanings one way or another. So I would say broadly Sky News is probably centre-right, that Channel 4 is probably centre-left. But the view has always been that the BBC is the sort of place we all come from all sides of the political aisle, from all different parts of the country, different societies, different worldviews, as a sort of as a town square to get the basic facts and basic news, things that we can at least attempt to agree on. There is a coordinated effort by people who I have previously called plastic patriots, who will drape themselves in a flag and will climb a pole to put up a Union Jack or a St. George's flag, but have no problem with an American president who, A, puts tariffs in this country, but also wants to destroy something that has been a central tenet of British society, of British culture, of British entertainment, and that's the BBC.
Yeah.
I have massive disagreements with the way the BBC covered Israel. I think the way that they've covered Israel is unforgivable and has been atrocious. But the BBC is part of British culture. It's part of British society. We want to improve it. We want to make it better. And I don't see how any person who claims to be a patriot or who believes in a fair media ecosystem in this country can run a coordinated or be part of a coordinated campaign to destroy the BBC. And nothing exposes that more for me then the embarrassment of a journalist, the joke of a plastic patriot, that British journalist for GB News who was in the White House, who in the White House press corps asked a question which, in my view, was an attack on the BBC to the White House press secretary, calling themselves GB News and also putting the little Union Jack in their logo, but then in what I feel is a coordinated attack on one of the sort of pillars of our media and our culture. So, I think this isn't an accident. This has nothing to do with the Panorama story, which I think you're right, probably warranted an apology because of the way that was edited. But, I find it ironic that people are cheering on Donald Trump as he destroys yet another part of British culture and society and politics and life.
We should also point out that according to YouGov, if you ask members of the public if the BBC is politically biased, more people would say it's biased in favour of left-wing political views.
Yeah.
And then 20% would say it's biased in favour of right-wing political views. And then 20% say, no, it's not biased. And then 30% say, don't know. So there is no consensus about where the BBC is.
We're nicely evenly split. Huh?
And I would say, in defence of the BBC, if you're pissing everybody off on all sides of the political spectrum, then you're probably doing the best job you can. We know that newsrooms have all kind of stress and time pressures, and I agree with you about the coverage of Israel. But in general, is the BBC broken? I don't think so. And I think Richard Bergen put it very well when he said on Twitter, the BBC story isn't about the editing of a Trump speech. It's about private media giants trying to undermine a public broadcaster to grab a big market share for themselves, boost their own profits, and reshape the media landscape to look ever more like Fox News.
That's a good tweet. That's basically what it is, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to... just an extraordinary story. This is why I'm not on X, okay?
Yeah.
Because it's someone described it to me as the kicked in the balls factory, as in it's the place you go if you want to get kicked in the balls, and I think that is true. Why are the right so weird about young women and young people in general, okay? The Youth Parliament was held in the Commons this week, and Twitter was riddled with right-wing people raging that a young person with they-them pronouns and dyed hair existed and had the impunity to be in the chamber. So Patrick Christus, who is a GB News presenter with 214,000 followers on X, this is a grown man, shared a video and photos of the minors in Parliament saying, I'm a she-her and I have mid-length black hair. James Hansen, LBC presenter, said, this is the strongest argument yet against Vote for 16-year-olds. Tom Harris, a former Labour MP for Glasgow South, said, I can live with most of the votes I cast as an MP, including my vote for the Iraq War, but I'll never forgive myself for voting to allow this lot to use the chamber. I can go on and on. Some Scottish Tory parliamentary candidate called Jordan David Cowie said, are future politicians in the making as a chamber of total write-offs? A collection of teenagers nurtured and encouraged to indulge in their self-inflicted mental health crisis and told they should be empowered to do so. I feel such despair for our country's future. What a bunch of bullies. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
I can't believe this is the level that people have stooped to on X. I really am shocked at this.
So here's the thing. James Hansen, what is it? Patrick Christie, Tom Harris was a former Labour MP. David Cow. Get a fucking grip, you absolute losers. Like, to log on to a social media account and attack in such incoherent ways, children, minors, people who are 16 years old, who are just engaging in the political process because you disagree with them, or better yet, and what's actually happening here, because you're so talentless and unable to convince them of your ideas that you are crashing out because they have different political views to you and you just can't convince them, and you know the next generation aren't going to buy your establishment simping, billionaire loving CEO, can't use the words I was going to use, but flagellating sort of politics that you hold, that you'll attack minors who've gone into the House of Commons to essentially close the gap between the most powerful in our country and ordinary people. Can I remind you, it's called the fucking House of Commons, right? It's supposed to represent all of us. Someone said on Twitter, I don't remember who it is, but folks can go find it, that the reason that they're so upset with this is because the House of Commons is supposed to be this sort of iconic chamber, and you should only sit in those seats if you've been elected, and it should be reserved for the few people who have had the privilege of being elected, and ordinary people shouldn't sit on it. That's the best example of the way that these people think, right? They hate this country. They hate the people of this country, the ordinary folk who won't get to sit on those green seats, and they want to maintain power and privilege for the very few that happen to sit on those green benches and those red benches. Mm-hmm. And they were incensed at the fact that ordinary people, and in this case, children, were sat on those green benches because they think that it should be only for the CEOs, the billionaire class, those who are born into wealth and privilege for those seats. And they are literally some of the lowest forms of political actors in this country. And the whole point of the House of Commons is it belongs to all of us. The whole point of these corridors of power is that it belongs to all of us. And so there's nothing wrong with these teenagers essentially closing that gap in their own minds and in the minds of their colleagues by taking part in this process. So get a fucking life.
I would also say that the Telegraph, LBC, the Tories, GB News are all exactly the kind of outlets or political parties that complain about young people being sat on their backside, mm-hmm. not contributing to society. And when they're faced with a group, the youngest person there was 14 years old. They decide instead of to congratulate them for their bravery, because that is an extraordinary brave thing to do as a child, I have to say, they choose to mock and deride them and post photos of them for their followers to pile in. I think it's absolutely extraordinary.
Let's do this, actually, if producers don't mind. James Hansen, Patrick Christie, Tom Harris, Matthew Bridger, apparently, who I don't know who that is, Jordan David Cow, and if any of you have the basic human courage, come and say this on the show with two adults who can argue back with you and who you can't restrict their replies. Let's tag them on this and see if they have the basic human courage to fight someone who fights back. The fucking losers.
Oh, good. Okay, well, listen, I just want to wrap up with one comment from Twitter user Anglo Pigeon, who has 1.2 likes, who tweeted...
1.2 thousand likes.
So many browns and mentally unstable white women, truly sickening stuff, which I think sounds like a good advertisement for this show. So if you enjoy that, please keep listening.
Rebrand politics.
Okay, that is it for the Week Unwrapped. Coming up, we'll be discussing allegations that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, my goodness, remember him, is plotting a coup against Keir Starmer. We'll be back.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When I've met people in the past, I'm like, oh yeah, I really love him, he's the one. But I just knew they weren't. I'd say it, but I knew I didn't mean it. But when I met you, there was a different feeling. Like, it's like your gut just tells you. When people used to say, when you know, I was like, oh, piss off. But when you know, you know.
When I met you and times got hard, I would come up with a strategy to make it better.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yeah. The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
So we've got Dr. Matt Morgan. Someone's heart stopped beating for 8 hours.
So he was stuck on a ledge in a freezing snowstorm, and his heart stopped for an amazing 9 hours. He's still the world's longest surviving cardiac arrest patient. And he lived because he was cold. You know, there's a saying, you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Let's go back to the beginning. A mortgage advisor. What does a mortgage advisor do?
So, the main purpose of a mortgage advisor is to help you to achieve the best possible mortgage solution on time and first time. Typically, in the modern day, it's somebody who's going to hold your hand through the full home buying process, liaising with solicitors, estate agents, helping with insurance, and being in your corner on your team to make sure you achieve that goal.
Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Greenewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Keir Starmer is seeking to investigate the briefings that Health Secretary Wes Streeting is staging a coup to replace him. I wonder who might have started that. Wes Streeting has belittled the attack, claiming that Downing Street has been watching too much Celebrity Traitors. Ali, I'm not going to try and explain to you what Celebrity Traitors is, because I bet you don't know, do you?
No, I don't know.
Okay, so don't worry about that reference.
Yeah.
Do you think Wes Streeting... You know what a traitor is.
I was going to say, are Celebrity Traitors different to normal traitors?
Not really, actually.
No, right.
Do you think Wes Streeting has the knives out for Keir Starmer?
It's been an open secret in Westminster that Wes Streeting plans on running to be leader of the Labour Party when Keir Starmer is done. I think what's remarkable is the sort of how poorly this response from Number 10 has been. So clearly, the feeling in Westminster seems to be that Keir Starmer got wind, or his team got wind, that they were going to move against him after the budget, where there's expected to be tax rises, and that will hit Labour very, very hard. And Labour is already polling at absolute disastrous levels. Keir Starmer is polling below Liz Truss was before she had to resign. So it's possibly one of the worst rated prime ministers in terms of approval in my lifetime, maybe since polling began. And so they got a sense that a move might be made against them after the budget. The consensus has been that Keir Starmer will have to go after the next May elections if they go the way that we're expecting them to go. But perhaps the thinking in Number 10, or the noise I heard in Number 10, was that might come sooner. So they launched a swathe of attacks, largely against Wes Streeting, who one can imagine is one of the people in the Senate as Julius Caesar walks in with the knife ready to put it in his back. That's been the consensus. But what's been amazing is how much this has backfired on Keir Starmer. If it was possible, it's made him even weaker, because the noise suggests that there are 50 people on the front bench ready to resign if this budget goes really, really poorly. And it's basically, what it's done is exposed how fragile Number 10's grip on power in the party and is basically in Parliament.
Did you just say there were 50 front benches?
That's what I heard. Am I breaking that, or is that... That must have come out.
I've not seen that. So
the noise I heard, was that there was as many as 50 front benches that were ready to resign, yeah.
Ooh. That is all the front benches.
But I think what the briefings by Keir Starmer suggested was that you can't move against me because it'll hurt the gilt and the bonds and the government borrowing, which is the most Keir Starmer way to defend yourself politically, is not to make sort of passionate argument of what the story of this government is and what we're trying to accomplish together, and maybe some loyalty and long-term vision, and this is where we're taking the country, that would be how I think a competent political operation might fight against rumours of coups and destabilisation. But as has been the MO of Number 10, it's, oh, but the gilt markets might hurt the country.
I also
the
just feel like we're in a kind of...
The borrowing, Zoe, the borrowing.
I feel like we're in a kind of abusive relationship with the gilt markets, because it's like we have to constantly appease them.
Yeah.
And all they do is throw shit back at us. Yeah. Like, we're like, oh, we can't, you know, you can't do anything because of the gilt markets. And then they're just like, oh, suddenly I've wiped out your £30 billion black hole. Sorry about that. Yeah. Woo, aren't I so careless?
Sure, what it feels like, Zoe? My relationship with Manchester United.
Really?
I just give them money and they abuse me, and then I go, I drive 4 hours to watch us get battered.
It's a toxic relationship.
And then on the way home, they're like, oh, by the way, can you get, your tickets are going up by another 20%.
I mean, I don't want mortgages to rise like they did under Liz Truss, and I don't want pensions to plummet and all that kind of stuff. But at some point, I do think we need to be asking ourselves, is this constant trying to appease the bond markets and the, you know, the overlords and the all that stuff that the public don't really care about or understand, and much of it is self-inflicted anyway, is it working for us?
Yeah. By the way, what I think will happen, I don't think any of these kind of... I think the briefings have hurt Starmer more than anything. He's in a weaker position he is now than he was when his team clearly briefed them. I don't for a moment believe or buy that it didn't come from Number 10, these briefings. Because if you just look at the kind of journalists that were putting it out, you know exactly... I think I know exactly who leaked it.
Yeah.
But so if anything, it's made them weaker. But what I think is happening is there's a combination of things. One, the polling is so dire. You've got 2024 intake of MPs who are going, well, no matter what happens, I'm losing my seat, right? So that the whip doesn't withdrawing the whip doesn't have the same fear it does with others, because they're like, well, I'm toast anyway in my constituency. The fear of Labour breaking one of its central promises in the manifesto on income tax and how badly that budget will go, the fear of the May elections, I cannot see how Keir Starmer survives this.
Sorry if I just didn't take in your answer, but do you think that Wes Streeting was preparing to launch a coup against Keir Starmer?
I don't know if he was preparing to launch a coup after the budget, but I think Wes Streeting is preparing to run for leader of the Labour.
That's what I thought you said. Okay, so if Wes Streeting wasn't preparing to launch a coup at this moment in time, which I would be surprised if he was, because
that he was planning to
at this moment in time. Because
can I tell you why it wasn't going to happen after the budget?
Well, let me just finish one second. There has been, months and months of bad news for the government, and it does feel like it gets worse and worse. But it's not like there has been a singular moment in the past week that I would say this is where a leadership coup is going to come from. Perhaps if it was following the Carefully by-election, for example, you'd think that would be an ignition point. But this seems to me to be a bit random. So my question is, why would somebody feel the need in Number 10 to put this rumour out there to then squash it? What's going on? Is it testing the water? Is it trying to kill Wes before he has a chance? Is it a double bluff? Is it putting Wes out there so he can go on the media round and look amazing and do all these cultural references and then actually positioning himself as a leader? Or is it just trying to start the tick, tick, tick of, oh, they're thinking about the next leader. Who's it going to be? I mean, what's going on? What in the 4D chess?
Well, yeah, I did get a few WhatsApp messages from people telling me that this is 4D chess. They're actually promoting Wes Streeting by doing this. I mean, that's what's ended up happening, whether they meant to or not, because it's gone so poorly for Keir Starmer. Some people think that's happening. I can see that maybe being true. I don't personally believe it. I think what's happened here is, and this is, for folks listening, this is how dirty and unhelpful politics is, right? We're in a midst of a cost of living crisis. Everyone's shit scared about the winter coming, from the NHS winter crisis that we get every year, pretty much since COVID, that's getting worse, to people not knowing how they're going to afford groceries during Christmas, let alone the presents that they want to give their kids and all that kind of stuff. Bills are going up. The water bills are crazy. The electricity bills are crazy. So the country's in an absolute fucking state. In the midst of all that, what's happening in Westminster, people are thinking, and I think this was the thinking from Number 10, the budget will land badly because they're going to increase income tax, it looks like. I think that's pretty much confirmed. And Labour will hit, I think, a record low polls in terms of the backlash to the budget. And I think Number 10 thought that that was the moment that, that West Streeting and others would strike.
Right.
That this is untenable.
This is preemptive.
We've broken a manifesto pledge. Something needs to change. And I think what Number 10 thought was we need to preempt that by launching an attack on the person who is probably at the front of one of the fronts of that race. And I also think that they think, because I've heard this, that West Streeting is moving before Andy Burnham has a chance to get back into the PLP. Because if Andy Burnham's on the ballot, he wins. If Andy Burnham is one of the options to be the next Labour Party leader and Prime Minister, he wins, because he's the only one that I think reasonably will save Labour from reform. Now, the reason I don't think Wes was going to move is because the noises I'm hearing is all the leadership contenders, and the names you hear are people like Wes Streeting, people like Andy Burnham, but also people like Angela Rayner, who fancies a go at it, want to wait till after May because they don't want to become leaders and they get hit by the worst local election results. So I still think the moment that, that Keir Starmer's premiership comes to an end is after May, and I think they've moved too quickly, and I've actually hurt themselves. But it's, again, it's not particularly politically competent. The stuff that I'm hearing is that members of the cabinet are demanding that Morgan McSweeney go as a result.
Well, I wanted to ask about this because Morgan McSweeney, who is the chief aide to the Prime Minister, has long been a figure of fascination and very, very strong views for anybody who's interested in internal Labour Party politics, but also just the governance of the country. He's very much been credited with Labour's election win by those who like him.
Yeah, that's such a generous assessment.
Yes, but he has also been criticised for being way too focused on campaigning, on focus groups, and not giving Keir Starmer the focus necessary to actually govern. He's also very much kind of the blue Labour persuasion, the much more sort of conservative caucus of the Labour Party, much more to the right, and has been the sort of purge of the left in the Labour Party in recent events has often been tied back to McSweeney's camp as well. There are calls for Morgan McSweeney to go, which is, I find interesting, because nobody's actually said Morgan McSweeney's leaked this. So why are people now talking about Morgan McSweeney?
I think Morgan McSweeney is being blamed essentially for the entire operation because he's the head of the ship. And people actually see him as more behind the decisions than even Keir Starmer is. And so I think the view, I mean, what I heard, and I don't have great sources on this because I don't particularly know anyone in the cabinet well, but the noise I've heard through secondary folks who do know people are that basically what the cabinet are saying is this is a mess. These briefings have gone so, and they need a scalp basically, and they needed someone to be senior, and Morgan McSweeney is the most likely. I mean, people have had the knives out for him anyway, because I mean, if you look at all the first year stuff, like the two-child benefit cap, which they're having to U-turn on now, which they withdrew the whip from people, the disability cuts, the winter fuel stuff, all of that has pretty much been put at the foot of Morgan McSweeney. So I'll make a prediction. I think he will go.
Morgan?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think it's the way that Starmer survives until May.
I actually wanted to ask you briefly before we go to a break about, so Number 10 have said they're going to open a leak inquiry to try and figure out who leaked this information. Now, my view is, aren't leak inquiries totally fucking pointless? Am I wrong? If someone's just had an off the record briefing with a journalist in Portcullis House or down, you know, the two chairmen or whatever, how can you possibly? Journalists aren't going to reveal their sources.
Can I tell you something on this? Which is might be I've never said this publicly. A few years ago, there was a briefing, a leak from not number ten, but was Lotto at the time. That was racist. Essentially, I think it was this comment about shaking off the fleas, and it was in reference to Muslims leaving the Labour Party, and they used the term shaking off the fleas, which was horrendously racist. Keir Starmer personally told me in a meeting between me and him that he was going to launch an investigation, a sort of leak investigation, to find out who briefed that, and that he would get to the bottom of it. Never heard anything about it ever again. Never referenced it again. Stopped replying to our calls for, you know, what's the outcome of this, because there can be no outcome for this, because you can't find out who leaked it. Even though if you stand outside Portcullis House and ask 10 people, 9 of them will tell you, give you a list of 3 or 4 names as to who it could be, and you're probably
be a very good advisor if you wrote your big piece of news down on a traceable message, and nor would you be a good journalist if you kept those kind of messages and showed them. So leak inquiry, my bum, I think.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Okay. I mean, you're a journalist, right? You'd never get. You'd never tell someone who's like it. Just
no, but they don't. They don't talk to me anyway. Anyway, some of them. Some of them do. Not as many as they used to. Anyway,
when Andy comes, he will.
Oh yeah, Andy does. Okay. We're going to go to a break, and then after the break, we're going to be talking about the 23,000 emails released by a congressional committee on Wednesday that have furthered the connection between Donald Trump and that virus that infects everybody who comes into contact with him, Jeffrey Epstein. See you then.
FUBAR Radio.
What the hell with Georges Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
Up now is Ephraim Mason-Clark, professional footballer. You got the chance to work under Frank Lampard. Just tell me a little bit about him.
The first day he came in, it was just like, the word isn't starstruck, but it's just like, this is a legend in not just English football, but football in the whole world. So at the start, it was more of like, wow. And then it's like, you just switch off from being a fan to this is like the gaffer now.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay, on paper, my type has to have a good soul, good purpose and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I wanna find happiness and I need him to be kind.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
A string of 23,000 emails were released by a congressional committee on Wednesday that have furthered the connection between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said Democrats have selectively leaked emails to create a fake narrative to smear Donald Trump. She said that Trump kicked Jeffrey Epstein out of his club decades for being a creep to his female employees, including Jeffrey. She also said these stories are nothing more than bad faith efforts to distract from President Trump's historic accomplishments, and any American with common sense sees right through this hoax and clear distraction from the government opening back up again. Lots and lots of extraordinary things in these emails. Epstein wrote in August 2018 to a top lawyer who served in the Obama administration, "You see, I know how dirty Donald is." Epstein also wrote to former New York Times reporter Landon Thomas Jr. in 2015, "Would you like photos of Donald and girls in bikinis in my kitchen?" Epstein added, of course he knew about the girls. He asked Ghislaine to stop. Trump has, of course, denied any involvement in Epstein's crimes. J.D. Vance, the VP, tweeted in 2021, what possible interest would the US government have in keeping Epstein's client list secret? I mean...
Is that J.D. Vance tweet satire? Oh, it's in 2021. Okay, there we go.
So change of pace. This feels extraordinary, and we should say that the journalists and all sorts of people are still combing through the 23,000 emails, and there may be more to come pending this vote next week. But it now feels like a very hot, it's very difficult to argue that there was not a link between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein, which opens Donald Trump up to much more scrutiny about his relationship with the paedophile. Than previously he had been able to shake this off. But of course this is going to open up huge divides in the Republican Party, because Trump based much of his campaign on draining the swamp, on trying to reveal these emails and reveal this link between Jeffrey Epstein and all these politicians. And he was hoping that that would put more pressure on the Democrats than the Republicans. But now Donald Trump seems to be implicated.
Yeah, one of the problems he's got is his base are so conspiratorial on this thing. I mean, we've previously spoken about, you know, the sort of QAnon base who believe that the rich and powerful in America are all either paedophiles or criminals or that sort of stuff. And so a big part of the allure of his campaign was he was going to drain the swamp, like you say. He was going to smash the system, he was going to release all the emails, he was going to release what happened to JFK, all this kind of stuff, right? And sort of one by one he's backtracked on them, and I think this is what's most likely to pose a serious chink in Donald Trump, who has traditionally been quite Teflon on these kinds of issues, in his armor, because it won't be what's in the emails, because he's kind of able to say everything's a hoax and this isn't true and kind of just outright deny and lie in public, but by refusing to release stuff or by resisting the calls to release stuff, the sort of conspiratorial mind of his base starts to fill in the blanks, basically, of what's in them. Now, the things that we've already seen are pretty bad. You know, Epstein writing, like you've read out in 2018, I know how dirty Donald is. I would suggest following the videos during the first election, we all know how, you know, the video of him on a bus, we all know how dirty Donald is. But his links to Epstein are becoming harder and harder to deny, I think. And I do think that he's going to get increasing pressure from his own base. I think Marjorie Taylor, what's his name? Marjorie Taylor something.
Green.
Whom he's already kind of spoken out about this week, is starting to put the boot in a little bit. And so I think we'll see more of this stuff coming on. One of the emails I think is really interesting is Ghislaine Maxwell's email in 2011 that referred to Donald Trump as the dog that hasn't barked. Now, I'm just speculating here, but I suspect that they were concerned that Trump new stuff that he hadn't said. I'm assuming that's what a dog
sounds
that hasn't
like
barked
yes.
means. So I think there is a chance that there's more to come on this.
The BBC also reported that in 2018 messages about Trump, Jeffrey Epstein said, "I am the one able to take him down."
Oh, that's ominous.
Yes, he said. So these exchanges, which the BBC has not independently verified, is a text message chain from December 2018. An unidentified person, presumably redacted, wrote to Epstein, "It will all blow over. They're really just trying to take down Trump and doing whatever they can to do that." Epstein replied, "Yes, thanks. It's wild because I'm the one able to take him down." I mean, that's
a pretty creepy thing.
It's pretty. I mean, but this is the thing, yeah. Right? If you've built your campaign on flirting with conspiracy theorists, in making out like there is a huge kind of global operation of elitism and conspiracy and politicians deliberately not serving the best interests of citizens and really leaning into all this kind of really anti-institution, really murky stuff. You have to be whiter than white. You have to be as clean as possible. And Trump, if he had any relationship with Epstein, which is very, very hard for him to deny now, it's going to be very, very hard for him to shake that. And I think what is also extraordinary about these emails is just how many incredibly powerful people were associates of Epstein, emailed him, visited him, or went out to his island. You know, again, Peter Mandelson coming back up in this. Lord Peter Mandelson, who was sacked as the UK's ambassador to the US in September over his links to Epstein, was again mentioned in the new documents, show he was in contact with Epstein as late as 2016. I'm pretty sure that the emails that got Peter Mandelson sacked from the role were from 2010 or 2011.
Mm-hmm.
It is extraordinary how many rich and powerful people associated with this man, even after he was convicted of offences, sexual offences against children.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be impossible for Trump to shake this. And there is this big vote next week. The House is going to vote on whether the Justice Department should release all the Epstein files. And a Republican congressman has said he's already had a couple of Republicans tell his office privately that they're going to vote in favour of the release. Obviously, Trump doesn't want this. He said, I think that could snowball. And as you pointed out earlier, Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of them. That could be a huge moment, right? Mm.
I also think, let's talk for a second about people in the UK, because you mentioned Peter Mandelson, mm-hmm. who was made ambassador. By the way, a remarkable thing. I know you've spoken to this before publicly. He was made ambassador after we knew his links to Epstein.
Yeah.
Right? He was given one of the most important international political roles that the UK has after we knew his links to Epstein. Tony Blair, according to the BBC, met with Jeffrey Epstein while he was prime minister. That was reported in October 2025, so just last month. Of course, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, we call him now.
Mm-hmm.
Formerly known as Prince, was also had a relationship famously with Epstein. So I think it's really, really concerning not just how many rich and powerful people had a relationship with this guy, but also how many of them maintained power and control after all this stuff has come out, which really goes to question this whole cancel culture thing. Do you think, now this is my off the cuff thing, Hillary Clinton is sat somewhere going, you want to talk about emails now, Donald?
I know.
Right? But that's his problem, right? Because he played in the game of conspiracies and the sort of dark parts of the internet so much, and his base is so malleable to it, that this is why it could hurt him so much if this comes out, and particularly if it comes out with him kicking and screaming. So if he makes a lot of noise about the House not voting in favour of releasing all this stuff, and then it is released, I think will be a particular problem.
I just want to say, because I was very briefly before we wrap up, but I was speaking to a professor in Canada actually earlier about Donald Trump for a piece I'm writing, and he said something that I thought was really interesting about Donald Trump, which basically might go some way to explain why he doesn't seem to think through any of his strategies. He said, the strangest thing of all with Trump is that he lives outside of time. He has almost no sense of past or future, but instead lives in the combative moment, fighting to win the moment by moment, day by day. The battles do not add up to the story of his life. He has no story in his head about how he came to be and where his life might be going. He is not retrospective, prospective, or introspective. No past, no future, no depth. It's uncanny. He is what I call the episodic man, living in the current episode, striving to win the episode. He will do anything, believe anything to win the moment.
That's really good. Yeah.
I thought it was perfectly summed
and
up.
Kind of on that, did you see recently one of the, I think, only self-reflective sort of cognitive moments Donald Trump had on a plane? I think he might have even been coming back from the UK, where someone asked him, do you think you'll go to heaven? And he has this sort of clear-eyed moment where he goes, I don't think I'm heaven-bound. No. I don't think heaven is for me.
Finally, realist thing he said.
Yeah. Should we end with a quote from one of his survivors and one of the victims? Because I think it's important to center them as well in this discussion. Do you want to read it? The Annie Farmer, one of Epstein's accusers.
You go for it.
So Annie Farmer, one of Epstein's accusers and key witnesses in Maxwell's sex trafficking trial, shared a statement after these emails, which we've spoken about, have been released. In it, she said, the more information that comes out about Jeffrey Epstein, the more questions we're left with. Survivors deserve more than a trickle of information. She demanded the full release of the so-called Epstein files and said the estimated 1,000 women and children who were harmed by Epstein and his associates deserve full transparency. 1,000 women and girls.
I know. Extraordinary. Right. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about it more next week, right?
That's it from Politics Uncensored today. You can join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points.
And you can stay up to date with the show. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
But not on X. You can find me at Ali Milani on the ball kicking site X. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.